Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 12, 2018. This Thursday's class is the week 12 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is on the hindrances. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this is the 12th week of our 12-week Dhamma study. We've come to the conclusion of another class, and it really is remarkable. I don't remember the number of times we've done this here, but in general, as a Sangha, as we've really developed the basics of what the Buddha taught, but not, I don't mean that in only a basic way. It's really a thorough foundation. It's really remarkable how, as a Sangha, almost to a person, we've developed it. And tonight we're going to talk about what would continue to block our development. And a question came up a few times, and even in my own mind as I was putting together this course a few years ago, and the order of the different subjects, I remember thinking, should I put hindrances up front so people are aware of it? And then I, you know, in thinking about it, it's something that needs to be understood in context. And so just to say there's going to be hindrances to practice and they're these is kind of obvious, but almost so obvious as to say, well, I don't, you know, it's good to know that. And then get into something else where you'll see the prominence and the importance the Buddha gives to these hindrances, because he teaches them in relation in the sutta, the Nivarana Sutta. He teaches them directly in relation to the four foundations of mindfulness, which is a core teaching. If we're going to develop the Dhamma, we have to know the appropriate application of mindfulness the way the Buddha taught it. So I'll just go. I went through this rather in depth on Tuesday. I'm going to go through it not quite in depth tonight, but then get into a little bit different material. The Nivarana Sutta. The Buddha addressed those gathered. Friends, there are these five hindrances. Sensual desire is a hindrance. Ill will is a hindrance. Laziness, indifference, and drowsiness is a hindrance. That's usually written as sloth, torpor, or drowsiness. And I just think laziness and indifference are a little bit more modern terms that we understand. And it might even get more to the point, especially that indifference part. Restlessness and anxiety is a hindrance. Doubt, uncertainty, and skepticism of the Dhamma is a hindrance. And then the Buddha declares again, these are the five hindrances to be mindful of. The reason why I pointed out indifference, and this is kind of what came up Tuesday. Not kind of, it is. I'll just talk about it briefly. David brought up, is it okay to count? If you're having difficulty meditating otherwise, is it okay to count? And my offhanded remark was, if the meditator finds that okay, then it's okay. And that really is not how I feel within this room. In this room, I decided a long time ago, and I think we all understand that I'm going to teach only what the Buddha taught, because that's what I found to be most effective, and to be cautious about introducing anything else. And so within these rooms and within what the Buddha taught, he never taught to count or any other method of meditation or anything that is now called meditation. It really isn't, such as chanting or walking or visualization or even rituals. He never taught anything, any substitute for shamatha vipassana meditation. And I know that, you know, if more than a few people were listening to this, there'd be a great argument. So maybe I should be grateful for that. And and a good example of that is when we're using counting meditation, it's because we're having difficulty with what the Buddha actually taught, aren't we? The breath meditation is not enough does not provide enough of a distraction from these hindrances. So because I am indifferent to what the Buddha actually taught, I now have the ability to grant license to myself to do something else. So even now I've decided that I'm going to be a Buddhist practitioner and practice what the Buddha taught. But as far as meditation is concerned, I'll do something a little different. But, you know, usually the subtle and unrecognized thinking is everybody's doing it that way, and this teacher said it's okay, and so it must be okay, and it feels good, and it gets me to the point where I don't have to deal with my indifference or my, David pointed out that it might be restlessness that drives us to use counting or some other method rather than just being mindful of the breath. And so if you think about that, I'm feeling you might not be aware of it, that I'm restless or I'm indifferent and I'm having trouble meditating. So let me use that counting method that someone gave me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 9. Boy, my mind's no longer racing. I'm not thinking about that. It must work. This is great. And you now condition your mind to needing counting rather than recognizing that the underlying agitation was rooted in that type of mind that was conditioned. And further conditioning the mind certainly isn't going to get you past the hindrances. And again, the Buddha taught, when these hindrances arise, don't substitute another distraction. You address them directly with the four foundations of mindfulness. And so the rest of the sutta, which is very short, the Buddha instructs how to use the four foundations when these come up. But we've talked about that. So in meditation, the first thing we did, the first foundation of mindfulness, is to be mindful of the breath and the body. That begins to unite the mind and the body in the present moment as our life is unfolding. And the more that we are there, present with our life as our life unfolding, the less stress we have. We can't be caught up in past or future self-referential thoughts when we're simply present. And the way we begin to interrupt the process of distraction from what's occurring is by being mindful of the breath. And every time we do that, we're interrupting conditioned thinking that is conditioned to react to these five hindrances. So when another hindrance comes up, it can be seen as a feeling or a thought, such as ill will, one of the hindrances, to simply recognize it as such, come back to the sensation of breathing. And again, we're in a very direct way, we're using meditation as it was meant to be used, to interrupt that type of conditioned thinking that continually gives rise to the distraction of these hindrances. And the same thing with every one of them. And if you identify that as simply a thought, the third foundation of mindfulness, what does the Buddha teach us to do? To recognize that the impermanence of the thoughts arising and passing away, and come back to the sensation of breathing. And as the thought passes away and we become mindful of the breath, and now we're mindful of the breath arising and passing away, what have we done? We've now substituted the distraction of the thought or the feeling or the thought and feeling structure, and we've simply let it go. And now we're focused on what's occurring. And how do I know what's occurring? Because we can only breathe in the moment. This is the reason why any other substitution from the breath to something else is not nearly as effective. When I'm mindful of my breath, no matter how much resistance I might have to not being present, I can't help but be. No matter how strong my ego personality is in the moment, if I just bring my mind to be focused on my breath right in this moment, I have, in a word, defeated that aspect of myself that is prone towards distraction. Now, for most of us, initially, it only lasts for a moment. And when we find ourselves caught up in our breathing again, or in our thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing. That's the basic practice. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness, to be mindful of the present quality of mind, we are now able to be present with less than pleasant states of mind because we have trained ourselves to do that, because we understand the impermanence of it. And so even at that stage, when we find ourselves agitated, because we've left these hindrances behind, we no longer insist that my mind be any different than it is. We simply have peace with it. Is that clear? And that's really the sign of an awakened human being. And the sign of an awakened human being isn't that you are completely detached from the world and so it doesn't affect you. You are completely present in the world in a detached, impersonalized way, and so it doesn't affect you. You're simply able to be present with your life as your life unfolds. And the Buddha concludes this. Again, I'm not going to read the whole thing. To abandon these five hindrances, one should develop the four foundations of mindfulness. And that's the end of the sutta. So the Buddha first describes the common human problem that every meditator will have. And then he describes the antidote. He never leaves us hanging. And the other thing, I mention this often, as I started reading the suttas, the actual words of the Buddha, it struck me, the even though there's some suttas that are very long and they're actually very wordy, the Buddha never wasted one word. There's not an unnecessary or certainly unskillful word in any of the suttas. And even when you think about all that these are translations, the good translations, the true scholarly translations that maintain fidelity to what the Buddha actually taught, come across just that way. And even though they might be very, very repetitive, you understand that the necessity for even the repetition in it. And then taking that and bringing it to these five foundations of mindfulness, and to understand it in that context. The Buddha never wasted a word. He never wasted a concept either, including these. This is being mindful of these five foundations, these five hindrances, is to be mindful of the unskillful aspects that we've created in our own minds, so that just like we use the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, to bring mindfulness to our thoughts, words, and our deeds, being mindful of these five hindrances is to hold in mind these five things, and actually we see that there's 11 in these five categories, that if we are mindful of them to the level that they no longer affect us, we will be able to fully develop the Eightfold Path. That's what the Buddha is teaching here, and that's why he's referring it back to using a fundamental teaching, such as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, to address these problems. And you remember in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness how the Buddha first teaches that, and then he takes us through almost a progression of different suttas, such as the seven methods of awakening, and then concludes this sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta with the reminder that ultimate mindfulness, or the proper application of the Four Found Mindfulness, as he concludes the sutta, is to be mindful of the effect of five clinging aggregates and develop, be mindful of the Four Noble Truths. Excuse me. And the Buddha concludes both of those important suttas, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and the Anapanasati Sutta, the Breath Awareness Sutta, where he holds out the monks as an example of how to meditate. Again, usually a misapplication of that sutta, as instruction to meditate, two different things. And he concludes that sutta too with the importance of doing all of this, meaning engaging in the Dhamma practice, so that we can finally end our ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And the same thing with this. If we're not mindful of these hindrances, the hindrances will manifest in such a way that they will become a seemingly substantial block to awakening. In other words, it is by giving power, and maybe another way of saying that is by giving in to any or all of these hindrances, we are effectively creating the blocks to our own development. In other words, these hindrances arise within our own minds. They're not something that's imposed on us, and they're certainly not insurmountable when we address them correctly, meaning using the Dhamma itself rather than something outside of the Dhamma. Or even to do, in some traditions, it's often encouraged to examine, and I would say over-examine, and through examination and over-analysis, to overemphasize these things. The more we focus on these things, once I had a great teacher, Arnold Patton, I think he's still around, and he basically said, what you focus on, expand. And so, and that's the essence of mindfulness. If we're using these hindrances in the way that they're often taught, another one is if you have doubt, to dive into the doubt and examine the doubt and develop the doubt, make it a great doubt. And there's one school that actually, that's almost its entire focus. And of course the Buddha didn't teach. The Buddha said to be, when doubt arises, be mindful of it and put it aside. Don't encourage it. Don't analyze it. Simply recognize it as doubt, as he teaches here, and apply the four foundations of mindfulness, which means to see it within the framework of being mindful of the Eightfold Path. Certainly not to examine it or to encourage it, to examine it. It might be ill will. And there's an entire ritual in one branch of Buddhism, and it's almost taught as a complete practice, to use this practice to eliminate all the ill will that you might have. And an aspect of that is to take on all the suffering in the world as part of this ritual. And again, I'm not criticizing it, except to say that it's not something that the Buddha taught, and it only encourages distraction from the hindrances rather than deal with the hindrance itself. And so this is the Dhamma taught to the Buddha taught the Dhamma for individual awakening. So upon that awakening, we have the wisdom of the Buddha to go along with any underlying basic human compassion we have, rather than acting out in that compassionate way and letting and making compassion be your practice, like the Bodhisattva vow. The Buddha taught to awaken first. He understood that as human beings, unless we're completely pathological in our thinking, we all are basically compassionate. We do basically care for each other. The problem isn't that we don't strive hard enough to be compassionate. The problem is that, according to dependent origination, our minds are rooted in ignorance and we're prone to eye-making even during compassionate behavior. And so it often is not truly compassionate because there's aspect of selfishness or eye-making in that. And to understand that and to develop the Dhamma. So I think I expressed the importance of understanding the hindrances and abandoning. So that's our talk for tonight. There will be one more talk on Saturday on the hindrances. So I'd like to hear what you think about the talk. And you know, what might be interesting, because you've both been doing this, is how you've recognized and dealt with the hindrances as they've come up in your practice. So, Kevin, good to see you tonight.
See you too. Yeah, and as I was saying before the class, the hindrances seem to be ever-present, you know. I can focus on my breathing longer and longer periods of time now, but still... the mind will drift, and then I'll be grabbed by a certain thought, and then I'm able to recognize maybe which hindrance it is. If I'm thinking about some slight I had the day before or during the day or something like that, and then I start to have ill will for that person who might have said that, and I just have to recognize that that's ill will, and that has to be put aside. Yeah. And I just come back to my breathing as again and focus on my breathing as long as I can, and then I might find I'm worried about something in my house falling apart, and I think, well, that's kind of an attachment and a desire, and that can be dealt with later, but it's a hindrance, and put that aside, you know, and they can all come up.
Yeah.
So just as you said, and just as the sutta says, you just have to come back to the foundations of mindfulness, focus on you can realize that there are thoughts, because there always will be thoughts, and put the thoughts aside, and realize that there are feelings that will arise, and put them aside. And the hindrances are all part of those thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
So, just keep breathing.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. It's such a good example of how it works, you know? And they at times, you know, pick one or pick them all, they seem so substantial, and they seem to demand our attention rather than to simply dismiss it. But that's only when you continue to react to it, it just reinforces it. But when you deal with it directly, and what you're describing is a perfect application of the four foundations of mindfulness. It comes up, it's up. Come back to the sensation of breathing.
I think when I first started, before I really understood the hindrances, I would, you know, you start to analyze your thoughts, and then you start to criticize yourself even for thinking, well, why do I have these thoughts? That was not a good thought, and I must not be good.
Yeah.
I must be a bad person. And then, but that gets you nowhere. That's just more conditioned thinking and sort of down the rabbit hole, and then you have to just, now I know, or, you know, most of the time I know, okay, those are just thoughts, those are hindrances, put it aside.
Yeah. And that almost compulsion to analyze this, you know, and put blame on it, whether it's on yourself or others, which is really it's commonly taught that there's some value in that, you know. I mean, that's kind of what we're supposed to do. We figure out where to, and it just continues distraction, because even if the thought that's driving it is rooted in something that happened to us, which most of them are, the reflection on that past is rooted in ignorance, and we're no longer seeing even that situation clearly, even though our memory is driving it in a certain way. And that, I mean, that's been proven so often that, you know, you can't really rely on your memory. And so your interpretation at that time was rooted in ignorance of what's really occurring, compounded by your present view, which isn't clear on that, and it continues to agitate your mind. And so even though the memory is present and agitating your mind, it's not really here, is it? It's gone, except that we have now recreated that situation, which is the essence of conditioned mind. It's not, there's nothing there, but it sure seems like it. Unless in the moment we recognize it as distraction. Come back to the sensation of breathing. It's no longer affecting us. Thank you for that beautiful explanation.
It also comes back to karma maybe too, so that you can refine your mindfulness, then those past actions and past thoughts that keep hitting us in waves are now going to be modified by the current state of mindfulness, so that the karma can be also reduced and extinguished.
Yeah. It's just that way. I mean, that's the essence of dealing with karma too. You know, it in the moment as it's arising, just like we talked about when we went through the few weeks on that. If we're going to maintain the present quality of our mind and incline our minds towards full awakening as our karma is coming in, manifesting in this moment, if I can stay mindful of my breath and maintain a mind of equanimity, it just unfolds and falls away. If I react to it, then I'm reacting to karma and I'm increasing its presence in my life and it will just continue to unfold. So such a good point. Diane, how are you tonight?
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
I think the introduction to my breath has been the most profound thing that's ever happened to me. I use it, I think I've said this before, I use it all day long when thoughts are disruptive or angry or ill will or somebody cuts in front of me or something like that. I take a breath and it stops. I know it's taken me a while to even totally wrap my mind around the breath, because I have had teachings like in other areas, like in Christianity or something like that, where there was a perfection required or demanded, or what, you know, you had to attain it or something like that. And I just find for me that the breath kind of zeroes out everything. It zeroes out the eye making, it zeroes out when things are happening that I don't want them to happen, you know, that I don't like, or, you know what, zero. I come back to the breath, it's okay, that's life as it is. And it's an acceptance thing. The breath, for me, is, I don't know whether I'm not as poetic or something as you are, but I think that I'm thankful for the hindrances. I'm thankful to know these things, and for me it kind of zeroes all out to ego, and I'm recognizing ego a lot more in my life than I ever had before. And I mean, one of the things about ego is it doesn't want me to be happy. And or content or anything, that wants to keep me agitated, and that's very important for me to, you know, it's been a breakthrough sort of to recognize that. Yeah. I think I'm done.
Thank you. That you're getting to the core issue. But also to understand that this ego personality is itself rooted in impermanence and rooted in wrong views, and that's all that the power that it has. So once the wrong, it's not a true living entity. It's given manifestation from wrong views rooted in ignorance, and so there's truly nothing there. But because it's who we think we are, five clinging aggregates, it seems substantial, and that's the. But when we can address it with a through right view, understanding that this thing called me is simply an ongoing process rooted in those wrong views. We recognize our wrong views and let them go, and then we enter into what we truly are, which is then in the process of becoming Buddha, becoming awakened. Once the blocks to understanding have been recognized individually, we have to do it ourselves, and abandoned, then we have freed ourselves of these hindrances, and we are keeping ourselves directed towards awakening by not allowing these. It's how the Buddha taught these. And I think you both expressed that beautifully well. There's just something to be mindful of so that they don't block us and don't give them any type of personalization. They're simply to be seen as anything that has manifested in ignorance. There's nothing really there. But to not give them any power to continue to hinder or be a fetter in our awakening. And that's the important teaching. And it's a fitting conclusion to the end of the course, because as the end of the course, you could say that now the real work begins. So let's not let this block us. Let's be mindful of what could block us from complete development of the Eightfold Path. And it's just these hindrances as taught by an awakened human being. Diane.
I ran across something this week. This is not Buddhaese, but Hitler's speechwriter had something to say about if you tell a lie often enough, loud enough, people begin to believe the lie. And to me, that's the ego thing that I had believed so many lies as, you know, I was a developing personality and in ignorance. So many things were in ignorance. And I wanted to get the other part of it is what the breath does is neutralize that lie, you know, the lies that I choose to, and it allows me to re-script or, you know, let life happen as life happens, rather than having these conditioned lie thoughts that it has to be, you know, the projecting that we do and stuff like that. It's a freedom,
yeah,
of mind, and talk about spaciousness. That I can now create anything. You know, I can create. You know, I don't want to get into eye making kind of thing, but it's just the release of the baggage.
Yeah, that's why the Buddha started with that problem of ignorance. It is the ills, all the dukkha arises from ignorance. And it's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That, which is why he taught that, why he taught everything was taught in that context, because it addressed the problem of ignorance. The Buddha wasn't interested in anything else. All those, you know, again, the great questions when they were put to him, he said, that's just a distraction from understanding the nature of your own suffering is rooted in ignorance. So he taught a path that develops wisdom where there was one to empty ourselves of ignorance. The true meaning of emptiness. So next week's all four classes, including Wednesday's talk, is going to be on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I think it's the most appropriate time now, isn't it, to go right back to that. And also an online student pointed out to me, he says, how come you don't have anything on the website about the Dhammacakkappavattana? I said, certainly I do. There's a whole section on Four Noble Truths. He says, yeah, but not on that sutta. Wait a minute.
Really?
And I could, and so... I've been working, it point me back to something. I had been working on just that, and I kind of got away from it. So I finished it. Now it's on the website. So next week we'll go right back to that and talk about that, all four of our classes. So. But congratulations on concluding this this Dhamma study too. So thank you. Well, any other questions or comments? We'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta, as we always do. And let's do that. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.